You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe in the Wave Farm Study Center in upstate New York. On This Week in Radio News, we're taking a deep dive into how the war on terrorism heated up after recent attacks in Paris and California, and also domestic terrorism in Colorado, are all quickly changing policy in regards to online and other radio signals, cell phone communications, and others. There's now a war on encryption in Congress. And we're going to take a deep dive into all the headlines from this week and hear testimony from FBI Director James Comey, from the presidential candidates, and their views on encryption. And we'll also hear from an encryption expert who will explain why encryption is not the problem. On This Week in Radio News. On November 28th, the United States National Security Agency stopped the bulk collection of the metadata from Americans' phone calls. That came after a debate weighing Americans' privacy rights with the need to protect Americans from domestic right-wing terrorists with assault rifles or religion-fueled terrorists with improvised explosive devices. Now, though, after high-profile gunfights in Paris and California, almost everyone running for president is ready for less privacy and more spying on Americans, though much of what they said in the past week was incorrect or misleading. Democrat Hillary Clinton implied this week she wanted more surveillance, though she just lists what the government is already doing.
Depriving jihadists of virtual territory, just as we work to deprive them of actual territory. They are using websites, social media, chat rooms, and other platforms to celebrate beheadings, recruit future terrorists, and call for attacks. We should work with host companies to shut them down. It's time for an urgent dialogue between the government, and not just our government, government and the high-tech community to confront this problem together. I heard from some of you that you had a great session about technology yesterday and about how politics and society kind of go on in a linear way, even if it's an upward movement, but how technology is a disruptive force that leads to a real exponential increase in activity. And I think one of the experts on the panel said ISIS is an exponential force right now. Unfortunately, I agree with that. And that's why it requires us to bring together governments and high-tech experts to figure out how we disrupt them.
Facebook took down a pro-jihad screed by one of the California attackers, Tashif Malik, disabling her account last week. Quote, "We have to start looking at families now," unquote, Republican Donald Trump said this week. And previously, he has advocated for surveillance of some mosques.
Because we're losing a lot of people because of the internet. And we have to do something. We have to go see Bill Gates and a lot of different people that really understand what's happening. We have to talk to them, maybe in certain areas, closing that internet up in some way. Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people. We have a lot of foolish people. We've got to maybe do something with the internet because they are recruiting by the thousands.
Republican John Kasich said the California suspects had used encryption technology, though no evidence of that has surfaced in the media. The Guardian reported that Republican Marco Rubio, the Florida senator also running for president, said restrictions on Dragnet collection of metadata was the problem, blaming Barack Obama for signing legislation last summer, the Freedom Act, that forced the government to rely on phone companies to keep data on customers, unquote. Clinton and Kasich both called for companies to open back doors on encryption encryption apps, backdoors that critics say would allow hackers or even terrorists a way into secure websites. Bernie Sanders, a Democrat, wants tougher screening policies. Quote, "We have got to do everything that we can to protect the American people, and that means much tougher screening policies than we have right now. I think clearly Paris was an intelligence failure, and we need to be tapping the intelligence information that is being ascertained from countries all over the world," unquote. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit heard oral arguments in the latest net neutrality case December 4th, and attorneys with the Federal Communications Commission are saying they are optimistic the rules will be upheld this time. Quote, "The argument started off in a way that we took to be quite hopeful," unquote, said attorney Kevin Russell, who is representing consumer advocacy groups and other interveners who support the FCC's rules. Indeed, opposing attorneys in their first statement seem to agree that consumers access the internet over radio waves, where the FCC does have jurisdiction to enforce the rules.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court.
Good morning.
The principal issue in this case is whether the FCC has the discretion it claims to relegate internet service providers to common carrier status, and whether in doing so it acted lawfully under the Communications Act and the APA, an action that required it to take multiple legal and factual conclusions that it had previously and separately reached and reverse them all at once. The central basis for the FCC's action here is its contention that internet access has become a telecommunications service because customers today principally use it to visit third-party websites and obtain information from those websites. And that, the Commission says, is just telecommunications. And our principal point here is that even if we think of internet access as exclusively about visiting third-party websites to retrieve information from them, that capability alone is a core information service that Congress protected from common carrier status. Because in 1996, Congress wasn't looking at internet access the way the Commission is today. Congress believed that the best way to encourage investment and innovation in what it saw as a dynamic and extremely important technology was to give such services separate protected regulatory status.
Court is not expected to rule on the case for months, and their ruling may hinge on whether internet providers are delivering, quote, telecommunication services, unquote, or the more lightly regulated, quote, information services, unquote. Appeals Court Judge David Tottle previously wrote the appeals court decision in January 2014 that threw out the FCC's previous net neutrality rules. After the recent terrorist attacks in Paris, Colorado, and California, U.S. lawmakers are calling for much more surveillance and much less privacy. This moment in Washington, D.C. seems a lot like late September 2001, when President George Bush could get any spying power he wanted from Congress. All of a sudden, there is a rush to surveil in D.C. these days. Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Majority Leader, said he'll give any spying power President Obama wants. Quote, "He should tell us what legal authorities he needs to defeat encrypted online communications and reestablish our capture, interrogation, and surveillance capabilities," unquote, McConnell said. Quote, "I will urge high-tech and law enforcement leaders to make it harder for terrorists to use technology to escape from justice," unquote, President Barack Obama said in his address to the nation December 6th. But change won't just come from the top. Senators Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, and Angus King, an independent from Maine, on December 3rd introduced a bill requiring telephone companies to notify the government if they plan on altering their policies for storing consumers' phone data. On December 8th, the House Foreign Affairs Committee debates legislation called the Combat Terrorist Use of Social Media Act. The bill requires the White House to create, quote, "a policy that enhances the exchange of information and dialogue between the federal government and social media companies as it relates to the use of social media platforms by terrorists," unquote, and, quote, "a comprehensive strategy to counter terrorists and terrorist organizations' use of social media," unquote. Of course, in France, the possible legislation is even worse for civil rights. The Le Monde newspaper found leaked documents that show France's Ministry of Interior considering proposals to ban free and shared Wi-Fi during a state of emergency in France and to block the online privacy Tor network inside France. The latter idea would be nearly impossible, though French authorities certainly could make it difficult for non-computer experts to use Tor in France. This is Tom Rowe reporting for Waveform Radio and WGXC. All the work privacy advocates have done since September 11th may be erased with the bullets in San Bernardino recently. Politicians are using that as an excuse to expand surveillance and restrict privacy. The Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act is a perfect example of what is currently going on in the halls of Congress. The bill began as an effort to roll back the excesses of surveillance, and now is being turned into an all-access pass for federal authorities to snoop. The Senate and House both recently passed versions of the bill that were not raising objections with privacy advocates. House Intelligence Committee members have been working out the differences secretly lately and are now gutting the surveillance restrictions and opening back doors for snoops and hackers. Quote, "We've just learned that the Intelligence Committee are trying to pull a fast one," unquote. Nathan White, senior legislative manager at digital rights advocate Access, wrote in a recent email, quote, "They've been negotiating in secret and came up with a Frankenstein bill that has some of the worst parts of both the House and the Senate versions," unquote. Sources tell the Hill newspaper that House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, and other congressional leaders are behind many of the new surveillance sections of CISA. U.S. FBI Director James Comey testified at the Oversight of the Federal Bureau of Investigation Senate Judiciary Committee hearing December 9th, and he said American tech companies are working hand-in-hand with authorities on the war on planning terrorism on the Internet. Comey said he had no problems with the tech companies not being helpful about sharing terrorist wireless communications, but he questioned the business model of some companies, saying he wishes they would reconsider, since many of those companies creating apps and software that the U.S. government might not like are overseas. Comey's request seems odd and ineffectual. Here's his statement from December 9th, testifying at the Senate Judiciary Committee about the role of encryption in fighting terrorism.
As you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, I do want to give you a very brief report in my opening about where we are with respect to the challenge of encryption to our hardest work, to our counterterrorism work and to our criminal work. As you said, since we were last together, we've had good conversations with the folks in the tech sector and lots of different parts of this great country of ours. And those conversations have convinced me of two things, which are both good news. The first is we care about the same things. The tech companies and the FBI and everybody else involved in this discussion both care about safety on the Internet. We understand that encryption is a very important part of being secure on the Internet. We also all care about public safety. We also all see a collision between those things right now. We see that encryption is getting in the way of our ability to have court orders effective to gather information we need in our most important work. And we all agree we have to figure out whether we can maximize both of those values, safety and security on the Internet and public safety. That's good news. We're not at war. We care about the same things. The second piece of good news is all of those conversations have actually convinced me it's not a technical issue. Right? There are lots of folks who've said over the last year or so, we're going to break the Internet or we'll have unacceptable insecurity if we try to get to a place where court orders are complied with. I actually think it's not a technical issue. There are plenty of companies today that provide secure services to their customers and still comply with court orders. There are plenty of folks who make good phones and are able to unlock them in response to a court order. In fact, the makers of phones that today can't be unlocked, a year ago they could be unlocked. So I really don't think it's a technical issue. And people also, I think, better understand today the government doesn't want a back door. That the government hopes to get to a place where if a judge issues an order, the company figures out how to supply that information to the judge and figures out on its own what would be the best way to do that. The government shouldn't be telling people how to operate their systems. So we are in a good place in terms of what we understand about our values. We're in a good place, I think, where we realize it's actually not a technical issue. It is a business model question. Lots of good people have designed their systems and their devices so that judges' orders cannot be complied with. For reasons that I understand, I'm not questioning their motivations. The question we have to ask is, should they change their business model? That is a very, very hard question. Lots of implications to that. We have to wrestle with it because of what's at stake. I'm limited in what I can say at this point about Paris and about San Bernardino, but let me give you a recent example. In May, when two terrorists attempted to kill a whole lot of people in Garland, Texas, and were stopped by the action of great local law enforcement again. That morning, before one of those terrorists left to try and commit mass murder, he exchanged 109 messages with an overseas terrorist. We have no idea what he said, because those messages were encrypted. And to this day, I can't tell you what he said with that terrorist 109 times the morning of that attack. That is a big problem. We have to grapple with it. And I very much appreciate this committee's support for grappling with the hard questions around this. We must resolve the collision of those two values. Mr. Chairman, at your request and the request of other senators, we are collecting data concerning the ways in which encryption is affecting our ability to implement court orders for data in motion, that is, emails or phone calls, and data at rest, that is, sitting on devices. And I don't know exactly where we're going to get that to you, but that work is in progress. And it will show there's a significant impact and growing across our work, both terrorism and in criminal cases. With respect to our conversations with the company, well, first of all, the second piece, with respect to its role in cases, I don't want to talk about Paris yet or San Bernardino because we're doing a lot of work with respect to those now. There's no doubt that the use of encryption is part of terrorist tradecraft now because they understand the problems we have getting court orders to be effective when they're using these mobile messaging apps, especially that are end-to-end encrypted. We see them talking about that all over the world. It is a feature of, especially of ISIL's tradecraft. Last, the conversations with the companies have been good. Like I said, they really have made clear to me that we're not at war with each other. We care about the same things. It's also made clear to me that it's really not a technological problem. We're not going to break the internet or expose us to tremendous insecurities of different kinds by requiring getting to a place where companies comply with court orders, because lots of good companies do today. It's a business model question. Good people have made a decision to design products and sell products where court orders are ineffective, and I'm not impugning their motives. I understand they see it as a competitive issue or they think it's just the right thing to do. The question we have to ask ourselves is there a way to get folks to change their business model so the judge's orders will be complied with? And if that can't be done voluntarily, what are the other alternatives? And these conversations continue within the executive branch and with our private sector partners. I know the administration, the Justice Department, is formulating a view on that.
FBI wouldn't want law enforcement to know what's being said on the internet that's terrorist-related or has complicity to commit an act. I should say conspiracy to commit an act.
No, the more we know, the better.
I would think so.
But I'm not in a position to offer a view on whether the Justice Department will support the legislation itself, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, fine. With respect to what you said on encryption, that you don't want a back door, you don't want keys, it seems to me that the probable cause warrant process is the best process. You said here today enough to indicate that you would support that. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, support? I'm not following.
Support. Legislation which enabled a warrant with probable cause to be able to look into an encrypted web, which you said the companies told you was possible.
Right. It's possible. Lots of companies do it today, provide secure services and comply with court orders. There are others who built their business models so that they say, even if we want to, we can't. But the question of whether the answer is compelling them to do that by legislation is one that I can't answer sitting here. I think that's something the administration a couple months ago decided not to seek legislation now. But I also know there's continuing to be conversations inside the administration.
Well, I'm going to seek legislation if nobody else is. And I think I know Senator Burr thinks somewhat similarly. I'm very concerned about it because when I met with High Tech, what they told me was there are parts now of when you talk to us about the dark web, which I listened to very carefully, that they cannot unencrypt. And I can give you the names of the companies that said that to me. And I have real concern about that. You know, I have concern about a PlayStation, which my grandchildren might use, and a predator getting on the other end, talking to them, and it's all encrypted. And so I think there really is reason to have the ability with a court order to be able to, and if you have cause to believe that criminality may be going on, to be able to get into that. I suspect what happened was in the aftermath of Snowden, particularly Europe, got very conservative with respect to encryption. The companies back away. Now that's changing with Paris, and God forbid what might happen in the future. So What I'm trying to say is I think this world is really changing in terms of people wanting the protection and wanting law enforcement. If there is conspiracy going on over the internet, that encryption ought to be able to be pierced. Do you agree?
I agree. I would very much like to get to a world where if a judge issues an order, companies are able to comply with it, either to unlock a device or to provide the communications between terrorists or between drug dealers or kidnappers. I very much would like to see that.
Good. Thank you very much. Thanks.
So far, we've been listening to views from politicians who've using scare tactics about encryption, but let's hear a computer policy expert from GData Software, Christian Gescott, explain why encryption matters.
Yes, hello from me to the GData Anniversary Summit. As said before, my topic today is why encryption matters. And we thought it would be a good idea to talk about encryption because data surveillance is a thing. And encryption by itself means different things to different people, and it's not very clearly defined. So we thought it would be a good idea to establish a basis. And it's also often used misleading in the corporate context to make customers give them a feeling of safety. So for today, the agenda is that we are defining encryption as in the state of encryption today. And then I'll give some ideas on what is happening with your data and who is interested in your data at all. Encryption today, and on the basic, encryption means it prevents a third party from accessing your data in any way or form. And data in this context can be anything from diaries to corporate data. And there's a very apt statement from Bruce Schneier, who is an American scientist, and he said there are basically right now two types of encryption. One that will prevent your sister from reading your diary, and then will prevent your government. And we think that right now there's really a necessity for a third type of encryption we will go to in a minute. And to define this basis, we will show you encryption today. Basically, what we said in the start, and this is Alice. Alice has a diary she wants to protect. So what she does is she uses some sort of encryption algorithm, and the data is kept to herself. Nobody is able to access that data. And if things get a bit more complicated, if Alice actually wants to share some data with Bob, because both of them now have to devise a way that only they can read that data, so they have an encryption algorithm and they exchange keys, things get complicated. But if everything works, which happens some of the time, only they can read the data they're exchanging, be it secrets, be it corporate secrets, anything. And if everything works, it prevents a third person, let's call him Chuck, from accessing that data at all. The problem is that this establishing this encryption and the encryption algorithm is very cumbersome and not very user-friendly, so more often than not, the encryption is not really working. And what happened in the recent days is that a new guy showed up, let's call him Dave. Dave is actually a very nice guy. It's can be alluded to from that picture. And he's offering a service to Alice and Bob to exchange the data. And he's telling both of them that the data they're exchanging is secure with him. And Dave is offering this service for free, and it's happening in lots of ways, and it's always the same message. Your data is safe. We are using the same encryption banks use. Nothing can happen to your data. The thing is that, as you can see from the arrows on the picture, that the encryption only happens from Alice to Dave's servers, and then from Dave's servers to Bob, and vice versa. On Dave's servers itself, there is no encryption at all, so Dave has complete access to that data. And the problem is that Dave has a service, and he offers it for free, but he finances his service by investors. And Dave has now the problem that the investors actually want their money back. So what Dave is doing, he is selling that data he has received from Alice or Bob to people like Chuck, to now have direct access to that data and don't need to break any encryption to actually get things working. And this is something that we are seeing today. In the slide here, you see the above, what we call transport encryption. This is what you're seeing all around the place. People are describing this in like, all data transfer is encrypted on the desktop and the phone. We perform security testing, blah, blah, blah. And what this actually means is that from your device to the server, there's actually no way, and this is true, there's no way to get hold of the data that is in transit. The problem is once the data has reached the server, it's very clearly accessible. And while this might be fine in a banking context, where the bank has no interest at all to give the data to anybody else, in the context of, let's say, a social network or a mail service, it's a very different topic because the mail provider has a clear interest to refinance his business. So he has a clear interest to sell your data. So what we actually would need in that context is what we would call content encryption. If you're looking out for statements where you say this service has content encryption implied, it's in the lower slide. You can see, in the lower part of the slide, you can see stay private. We cannot read your messages. No one else can. End-to-end encryption is a keyword that you will be seeing, and that is also something you would have to look out for if you really want to encrypt your content and not just on the way to the server of the provider. Good examples of the two encryption services in for the above is, for example, Google. They even have statistics about how much of their content is encrypted in transit. They are pretty transparent about it, which is a good thing. They clearly mention that this is only in transit. They in no way or form mislead the public in that they are actually encrypting content. But there are other providers who are not so clear in saying what they're actually doing. And a good example for content encryption is on the bottom. It's the services of TextSecure and WhatsApp. As this is a slide from an excerpt from a slide from the from a test where all the messaging providers were tested against security. And as you can clearly see, TextSecure basically aced in all of the categories probable, while WhatsApp only had like only 2 points where they could actually score, and none of them refer in any way or form to actually encrypting content, which means the content that is on WhatsApp is always available to WhatsApp or rather to Facebook these days. To show why it's important to talk about encryption is to give an idea on what actually happens with your data. Data means, in this context, two things. One is the data that you give away voluntarily, and the other is the data that you give away involuntarily, that is, the data that is leaving your device without you doing anything. And a good example of this is this walk I did in day before a conference in San Francisco, and was on a Sunday, and Google was so nice to track all the whole walk I did on with my phone, and they uploaded it to their servers. And now I have a good and clear reference at which cafe I stopped, and I think if they're really keen on it, they could also find out what I ate there. But you get the point that Google isn't right now basically tracking every movement that you are doing, and they're storing it. And this is from February, and it's still available, so you can be pretty sure they are storing it forever. And they are not going to delete that data for any reason or form. And that means they are also using that data. They have now have an interface which is called location history, so you can actually see on your own phone what they are storing, which at least means that you have a way to see what they are tracking, but there's no way for you to turn this off completely because they have ways to track you in either way.
Preceding show was recorded at Wavefarm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.